This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The deadline to take out papers for the Boston mayoral election expired this week, and the makeup of the field is historic. All six major candidates identify as people of color. That is a wealth of diversity, and it also brings painful questions about legacies of discrimination, identity, and belonging to the public forum. Yesterday, councillor and mayoral candidate Anissa Asaibi-George put out a forceful statement on her identity as the daughter of Arab and Polish immigrants after questions about her identity arose in an online podcast and a subsequent article in the Boston Globe. Councillor Asaibi-George joins us now. Councillor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Tiziana. I'm happy to be here with you.
So let me begin by asking you, why did you put out the statement yesterday?
Well, I think when you read the article in question, it's pretty clear that the narrative takes a turn when talking about me. Everyone else gets this nice paragraph about their background and the impact it has had on their life. And then there's my paragraph. And I think the article left out some critical context. They didn't give me an opportunity to respond or to talk about my identity and my family. And that was certainly very, very frustrating.
Why was that so frustrating to you?
Well, you know, when you are the Boston Globe and you help set the narrative, and by talking about how some may question me and my identity, you're validating a viewpoint that I think is certainly untrue and hurtful. The conversation they quote was actually a very great one. When we think about the politics and Prosecco, it was a wonderful conversation and one that I'm actually very much accustomed to having. I talk a lot about my background, about my identity, about my family, about my heritage, about my roots. And in that politics and Prosecco conversation, the host was very considerate in allowing me to answer and actually having a conversation about my background, because it's one that is certainly interesting and unusual. And that conversation was very different than the conversation I had with the writer of the Globe article. And, you know, we had a conversation last night with the Globe team, and I think that we're all on the same page, but it's just very frustrating. I am who I am. I'm very proud about my heritage. I'm very proud about my roots. I'm very proud about my family, where I come from. And I'm always very happy to talk about it as a first generation American, as someone who is Arab and Polish, and someone who identifies as a woman of color. I've been always very open and happy to talk about my story because it shares my experiences. It shares maybe a slightly different ethnicity, a different heritage than others maybe have experienced. And unfortunately, many Arab people live in this in-between space where our unique experiences and that discrimination that comes with it sometimes, you know, allows us to count for having that experience, and sometimes it doesn't.
All right, so let's dig into that a little bit. You made several references there to the podcast that Jaquetta Van Zandt does online, Politics and Prosecco. You did it back in February. In this conversation, I watched it. In this conversation, she raises this question of identity because she raises concerns about people who only claim to be of color sometimes. And you talk there about this challenge of feeling like you have access to more rooms than other people of color, but also because of your heritage, you don't have a seat at the table. I just want to ask you to spell that out a little bit more.
Well, I'll tell you very plainly, sometimes Arabs count sort of in the public space as people of color, and sometimes Arabs don't. And, you know, that's been something that I've certainly struggled with my entire life. It's certainly something my father struggled with here as a new immigrant to the United States in his younger years. And, you know, I think it's also important to note, and I talked about this with Jaquetta that evening in that podcast, that I don't ever conflate my experience with others. Sharing my story does not mean that I equate my life with or discount the struggles of other races and ethnicities.
And so let's stay on that for a second.
I also want to say that because of my experience or through my experience, I'm also hearing oftentimes of other people picking the identity that they choose for me. And that can present sometimes challenges.
So let's stay with that. I think one of the reasons that race is so essential to this election is that we're fundamentally grappling with our city's history of structural racism. One's racial identity can be a signal to voters about how deeply you've lived through and suffered from some of that structural racism. You do acknowledge not having a seat at the table, but also having more freedom of movement, being welcomed in more rooms. So how do you address the question of whether your lived experience gives you the perspective necessary to take on some pretty serious core issues of racial justice and systemic oppression if you were to be mayor?
Well, this, you know, discussion certainly exists and has existed for generations. It's one that I've lived through as my experiences as a young daughter of an Arab and an Arab Muslim. It is an experience I've lived through as the daughter of immigrants. It is the life I've lived growing up here in this city. And certainly my life does not equate or cannot relate to the lived experience of a Black person, that is for sure. But it does not mean that as the daughter of immigrants, as the daughter of an Arab in particular, because that tends to be the topic that we're discussing when we're talking about my identity and how I present, does not mean that I cannot lead our city through some really important conversations and some restructuring of our city to account for the structural racism that has existed in our city. When we think about the challenges in our school system, when we think about the systemic racism that exists in our transportation system, in our public health system, in our general healthcare system, in our policing system, when we think about all of these systems in which the mayor of this great city needs to lead on, not being of a particular race, and we can pick any which one, is as these conversations sort of go down these different rabbit holes, to have any one of these races does not disqualify me from being able to engage in these conversations and doing the hard work that is required of the mayor of this great city. And I look forward to leading the city through that time.
All right. In our limited time, let's talk about a couple of policy things. Earlier today, you were endorsed by former Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, who was the city's first Black police commissioner. Why is this endorsement important to you?
Well, I'm very grateful to have his endorsement. His confidence in my ability speaks volumes, I think, in our ability to be engaged in community, to build trust between law enforcement and the residents, to promote diversity and inclusion, especially in the police department. When we think about our city's efforts around public safety, when we think about the city's necessary efforts to rebuild trust between our police department and our community, I believe that Boston can be both safe and just, that these are not mutually exclusive ideas and concepts and efforts. We certainly need reforms and we need safety. And I believe that Boston can have both. And I believe that Commissioner Gross's endorsement of me today indicates his belief that I can make sure that in Boston that we do that, that we can achieve these things. And I am flattered that he believes in my ability, both my track record and my work going forward, to bring people together to have those tough conversations about creating true community policing here in the city of Boston. We boast of great successes, rightfully so, but we recognize the necessary work that's left undone when we think about the role of community policing across our city and every one of our neighborhoods.
You spoke a moment ago about the fact that we certainly need reforms. One of the places that you differentiate from other major candidates in the race is on the question of defunding the police. You don't support that. You support increasing funding for social services. So where do you see a need for the police to reform themselves, and how do you see that being done?
Well, it's across certainly all different aspects. We need to make sure that there is accountability and transparency in the work of the police department. And we need that if we truly do want to lead on community policing. And as mayor, I will push for critical reforms, including expanding implicit bias training, making sure that we have mental health clinicians to respond to the needs of our residents. That's work I've done on the city council, making sure that we are reforming the gang database and making sure that we are stepping up community outreach. Again, we need to make sure that our police officers are directly involved in our neighborhoods, building those relationships, and that our police department is reflective of our neighborhoods. We need to make sure that we have diversity in our ranks, and I will fight to increase diversity across the Boston Police Department, whether it's recruiting new officers directly into the force, continuing to build our cadet program, and making sure that we are promoting diverse candidates into leadership roles. We need to make sure that we are including real racial and gender diversity across all levels, especially in leadership roles over at BPD.
I think we've got time for one more question. A group of Roxbury and South End residents marched from the area around Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard to the State House yesterday, protesting what they say are inhumane conditions in the neighborhood. We've engaged with you a lot on this issue before. As mayor, what would you do to address the residents' concerns and provide for the people struggling with addiction in our city?
Well, you know, as the former chair of a committee that no longer exists on the Boston City Council, I did a great deal of work around homelessness, mental health, and substance use disorder. It's a priority. It has to be a priority. And when we think about this last year, we've lost sight in many ways of the work that we need to do to help our most vulnerable residents who are in a moment of crisis. We need to do this both in the city of Boston and work for a regional response, because we do have to decentralize all of the services that are really sort of saturating the area of Mass and Cass. So providing those good services, but making sure that we are meeting individuals where they are when they are in their time of need, making sure that programs are available, and making sure, and what I have suggested through this budget process, as we look to receive the recovery funds from the federal government, that we are investing them in responding to the needs of those dealing with, again, homelessness, opioid addiction, and mental health issues. We have a unique opportunity to get individuals the help they need with those funds, and do it quickly and do it with urgency.
Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Anissa Asaibi-George, thanks for joining us, Councilor.
Thank you very much, Tiziana.
Now, listening into that conversation was WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here, Tiziana.
Let me just start by inviting you to react to the discussion you just heard.
Well, the first part of the discussion I thought was interesting, and it's worth saying, you know, when it comes to these questions of race, it's complicated. I mean, let's begin with that. It's really complicated. So we have this incredibly diverse field of candidates running for mayor of Boston, and there are people in the city who want the next mayor to be a Black or a brown person, but it's not completely clear what that means, but to some, it's important to at least make a distinction between people who are descendants of formerly enslaved people who have experience dealing with the kinds of institutional racism that we've been spending a lot of time talking about, and people who are not. Now, Anissa Asaibi-George clearly represents diversity, but she doesn't necessarily represent that kind of diversity and that kind of history. And adding to that complexity, and I think she talked about this, in her case, it's not really clear how this country even categorizes her. You know, she was asked today how she filled out the census form regarding her race, and she said she left it blank because there is no place on the U.S. Census for a descendant of a person of Middle Eastern origin or North African origin to check. And Tiziana, one more thing. I would say this. I think it's really important to keep this in mind. There are six major candidates running for mayor. None of them is a white male. So whoever wins, it's going to break the mold and represent a historic change in this city, whether it's Kim Janey, Andrea Campbell, Michelle Wu, John Barros, John Santiago, or Anissa Asaibi-George. So a lot to digest there.
And to what extent are the candidates' personal identities, their lived experience, core to this campaign, Anthony?
Well, I mean, I think you heard Anissa Asaibi-George expressing that pretty well. There are others who are doing it. I mean, for example, Acting Mayor Kim Janey is running as a daughter of Roxbury, who understands firsthand the issues around inequality in this city. Another example, Andrea Campbell talks a lot about her twin brother and the radically different path that his life took from hers. She went on to law school. She's a city councilor. He was accused of terrible crimes, was stuck in the criminal justice system, and died in custody. So two very different paths that Campbell says speak to the need of big reforms around corrections and policing. One more example, Michelle Wu talks about being the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants who had to become a caregiver to her younger siblings when her mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So all three of them put these formative experiences front and center in their campaigns. And the other candidates are doing it in their own ways as well.
So you heard us talk about the endorsement today from the former head of the Boston Police Department, William Gross. You were at that event earlier today where she announced that. How important is this kind of an endorsement by a former major law enforcement figure in Boston?
Well, I mean, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. I mean, obviously, it's important to have a former police commissioner say to you, you know, we take you seriously. And one of the things Gross says was, I see Asaibe George in the neighborhood all the time. She doesn't just take pot shots at the police department. She's really interested in working with us. That's what he said. It's also interesting because Gross is an interesting figure in his own right. He was Marty Walsh's police commissioner. And one of the things Asaibe George has been doing is representing a kind of continuity with former Mayor Walsh. She aligns herself with Mayor Walsh and his policies and talks about the things that she was able to accomplish on the city council in partnership with Mayor Walsh. So she's trying to establish herself as that sort of continuity figure, if you will.
I wonder if there will be competition there with candidate John Barros, who served in the Walsh administration as well.
I think that's a great point that Barros can make. I mean, you can talk, you know, what does continuity mean? I mean, look at someone like John Santiago, who we haven't talked about lately. I mean, he's got an extraordinary resume as an emergency room doctor, as an Army Reserve captain, as a state representative. I mean, that represents a certain kind of continuity as well. But obviously, you know, going back to this historic notion that this is the most diverse group of candidates ever, and for the first time in 200 years, the city is not going to be led by a white male. It's a pretty extraordinary moment, no matter how you look at it and no matter who ends up winning this race.
You've been reporting on fundraising. Where are we on that, and how does Councillor Asaibe George compare with other candidates?
Well, she's doing pretty well. I mean, the leaders, the people with the most cash on hand, City Councillor Andrea Wu, City Councillor Andrea Wu and Andrea Campbell.
No, Andrea Campbell?
Yes, Andrea Campbell and Michelle Wu, forgive me, have the most cash on hand. Now, Anissa Asaibe George has done very well since the beginning of the year. She's raised a lot of money. Only Michelle Wu has raised more money than her. John Santiago has the same amount of cash on hand, so he's doing quite well as well. And Kim Janey has the least amount of cash on hand, but she did very well in the last month, raising over $200,000. So keep in mind that money is only one indicator of the race, but that's a quick snapshot of where the leaders in the money race stand.
Well, we are going to continue to watch it with you. There's several months left to go. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for the time.
Hey, my pleasure.
The 2020 election was 191 days ago. But in Windham, New Hampshire, right now, they are counting the votes again. Not to change any results, but to double check that the vote counting machines in Windham were operating properly last November. It's a process called an audit, and it's happening now because a state-run recount in a local state representative race held a week after the election resulted in a difference of hundreds of votes. So state legislators then authorized the audit on a bipartisan basis. Covering the audit is New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Casey McDermott. She joins us now with more. Casey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start at the why. Why is there a count of votes happening 191 days after the election?
Right. So as you explained, this all really started with a discrepancy in a single legislative race. And just for your audience as a refresher, there are a lot of legislative races in New Hampshire because we have 400 state representatives. So this was for one of those seats. The vote count was fairly small. We're talking about a race where only about 10,000 ballots were counted in total. And what happened was that there was one Democrat who fell short of you know, breaking up an otherwise Republican sweep of that town. She fell short by only about 24 votes on election night. She requested a recount. She was within the margin to do so. During that recount, however, that margin between the Democrat and the rest of the Republican candidates widened significantly. And what happened was that the vote totals for all of the Republican candidates increased by about 300 each, while the vote totals for that Democrat decreased by nearly 100. So we ended up with a roughly 400 point gap between the recount totals and the election day totals. So the outcome of the race didn't change, but it raised a lot of questions from people on both sides of the aisle as to what might be behind this. And even our Secretary of State, who's been in his position for well over four decades, acknowledged that it was rare to see a discrepancy as large as this one. So that, you know, after that recount, the Democratic candidate petitioned New Hampshire's Ballot Law Commission to investigate the situation further. The Ballot Law Commission in New Hampshire is the one that really has authority over ballot counting devices or other kind of election disputes that aren't otherwise resolved at the recount phase. They determined that they didn't have the authority to do the kind of investigation that people were asking for. They asked the Attorney General's office to look into the situation. The Attorney General's office said, look, we don't have the power, according to state law, to do this kind of an audit either. And what happened was basically, you know, frustrated by the lack of action by other state officials, a Republican state senator introduced legislation back in February designed specifically to authorize the audit that we're now seeing. So it took a little while for that to move through the legislature and go through all of the steps that it needs for a bill to become a law. But it was signed into law in April. And, you know, here we are today with that audit well underway here in New Hampshire.
So now it happens in four phases. Just briefly, what are the four phases?
Sure. So what they're looking at is doing an inventory of the ballots. So that's what's happening right now. They're just trying to make sure that they have a sense of what is the universe of the ballots that they're supposed to be counting in this particular community. Starting likely tomorrow, they'll begin hand counting all of those ballots. And then after that hand count wraps up, they're going to take a closer look at the ballot counting devices. They'll look at the memory cards, other internal systems. And then in the final phase of the audit, they'll look at some other kind of miscellaneous, election paperwork, other documents. They'll look at some ballots as well during that phase. So what they're trying to do is take kind of a 360-degree view of the situation to identify any potential explanation that, that there could be for that gap.
I got to believe that chain of custody of the ballots continues to be a big deal. So where have they been for 191 days? And how is chain of custody working now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the audit started in earnest on Tuesday, and a lot of Tuesday was actually just spent on that question. The ballots had to be transported and very carefully signed out of the state archives. So they were in the possession of the state. They were in a bunch of boxes sealed up with, tape. They had to be carefully signed out and then transported, across town to where the audit facility or where the audit is taking place. The other thing that had to be carefully transported in a similar manner were Wyndham's ballot counting devices. Now, those were in the possession
like
of the
machines.
Town. Yes, exactly. Yes. They're not connected to the internet or anything like that, but they are mechanical machines that allow communities to count large quantities of ballots at once, basically. And they those were still in Wyndham, so they needed to also be transported. And the audit team has been very methodical about making sure that they're keeping track of all of that equipment, all of the paperwork, all of the ballots. So even the act of just getting the supplies into the audit venue took a while so that they could account for everything.
When do we think this is going to be done?
That is an open question at this point. They are looking at likely stretching into at least next week, perhaps the week after. But what we do know is that by law, this has to wrap up by May 27th.
So soon. And who, yeah. I mean, this happened that you talked about. This is politics, right? This is races between Democrats and Republicans. There are people with political positions at play here. Who is waiting with bated breath for the results? And what are the likely implications of results?
Well, so the implications are, there's a few implications here. We should emphasize that this audit is not going to change the outcome of the race. Right. It's not going to overturn any race. But what it will do is hopefully give a better sense of, you know, what could have caused this, what is a pretty significant discrepancy in a race of this size. It also could have implications for the future of, for example, New Hampshire's ballot counting machines. We use really old machines, and those machines, we only have one model that's used statewide. So the state has already been in a process of kind of evaluating what the next phase of our ballot counting machines will be. And I imagine that, you know, the results of this audit will help to kind of determine what considerations they want to take into account as they're choosing that equipment. You know, I think there's also just a lot of people that are curious from a lot of different political persuasions about election integrity and, you know, to ensure that New Hampshire has processes in place that can give the public confidence that votes are counted and votes are counted fairly. There's no indication whatsoever at this point that there was any kind of malfeasance, that there was any kind of fraud, anything like that. It could have been simply human error, but that's, again, what this audit is meant to help to establish is where that error might have taken place.
All right, that's Casey McDermott, reporter for the New Hampshire Public Radio. Casey, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's look at how this fits into the national picture now. Jamie Bologna from here at Radio Boston joins us to help. Hey there, Jamie.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right, so I do want to put this into context, Jamie. What's happening in New Hampshire is just part of what's going on nationally right now. We saw the Republican Party vote to remove Representative Liz Cheney from her leadership position yesterday. So connect the dots for us.
Sure. That's exactly right. So this is all happening against this backdrop of an ongoing struggle within the Republican Party about the last president, the 2020 election, and this year's insurrection. And yesterday, the House held a hearing on the insurrection, and it was raucous, it was heated, and it really highlighted this divide between Democrats who want accountability for January 6th and Republicans there who were focused on defending the former president and his supporters. And Republican-controlled state legislatures around the country are also working on and passing new legislation on restricting voting access. So, for example, Texas is on the verge of passing a bill that would stop election officials from proactively mailing out absentee ballots or applications for absentee ballots, and it would make it easier for partisan poll watchers to get closer to voters. And Arizona, which is also in the midst of a very wild and complicated audit process like the folks up in New Hampshire, and their process could carry on until July, but it has no legal standing to overturn the results. They've passed a law this week that also limits the distribution of mail ballots. In fact, new restrictions, Tiziana, are already in place in 11 states, including Florida, Georgia, Arkansas, Idaho, and Indiana. And according to the Brennan Center for Justice, as of the end of March, some 400 bills restricting voting access have been introduced in 47 states. And again, the impetus for these proposals is this unfounded notion of widespread voter fraud in the last election.
Okay, so that is a lot and is connected to the falsehood from former President Trump that the election was stolen. We know that's a false claim. This was a legitimate election. But what has the former president been saying about all of this?
Well, remember, he's still banned from Twitter and Facebook, but that hasn't stopped him from launching his own website, and he uses it basically the same way that he used to use Twitter. He's been regularly writing about the last election, and here's what he wrote in part about the audit in Windham. "Congratulations to the great patriots of Windham, New Hampshire, for their incredible fight to seek out the truth on the massive election fraud which took place in New Hampshire and the 2020 presidential election. People are watching in droves as these patriots work tirelessly to reveal the real facts of the most tainted and corrupt election in American history," end quote.
Okay, so just want to reiterate, no evidence of widespread problems after
right.
the election. Okay, so let's come back to Massachusetts now, because this resonates here at home, too. Governor Charlie Baker's been one of those Republicans who's tried to keep his distance from the former president, often condemning some of, you know, the more inflammatory rhetoric mm-hmm. from Donald Trump over his term. Has he said anything about the party's apparent turn towards embracing, quote unquote, the big lie and what's happening right now?
Yeah, so Governor Baker is sort of, as always, in a complicated position. He's a popular Republican in a Democratic stronghold state, and he's been very clear about the election and the results, that Joe Biden won fairly. And as you mentioned, he's also been pretty artful over the years to distance himself from Trump, but not the party, and he did that again yesterday.
I've been a Republican since I was 20 years old. And I continue to believe in what I consider to be sort of the core values of the party. I've had my differences, as everybody knows, with plenty of folks in the party over the course of the time that I've been in public life. But I'm a big believer in what the party fundamentally stands for, based on what I believe it stands for.
And I should note, he also stopped short of joining some 100 other Republicans, including his former boss, Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, in signing a letter threatening to leave the party and form a new party if the GOP doesn't turn its back on Trumpism.
And as on that, Jamie, I understand that yesterday when he was asked about it, he said that he had not yet been even shown the letter.
Right. But he's been clear throughout his tenure that he is a Republican. He's proud of it. And he's proud of the party. He's just not proud of this turn.
All right. So what are you going to be watching for as we move forward? What should everyone be watching for, Jamie?
So I'm personally, and I think everyone should be watching closely, this battle, as I mentioned, within the party, between those who sort of wholeheartedly support the former president and his continued baseless claims about the election, and those perhaps like Liz Cheney or even Governor Baker, who would like the party to move on, to chart a new future without Trump, post-Trump. Though I will say, Tiziana, I know it's dangerous to read the tea leaves, but with Cheney ousted from leadership and moderates sidelined, and even recent polling showing 6 in 10 Republican voters believe the election lie, it just doesn't seem like the sort of move on crowd has much of a chance here to shape the future of the Republican Party. It may just be a situation of sour grapes.
All right. That is Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. Thanks for watching it and bringing it home for us, Jamie.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. That is the sound of Hume Domini by Vicente Luciciano, performed by the Fall River Symphony Orchestra Principal String Quartet. Luciano is one of several composers of African descent that the Fall River Symphony is highlighting, composers whose work has been widely unrecognized by the mainstream classical world. It was the idea of director and conductor Douglas McRae Daniels, who says following last summer's reckoning with racial justice, the symphony debated whether it should issue a statement in support of Black Lives Matter. But Daniels, who's Black and had been thinking of doing this long before last summer, thought there was a better way to address what was happening around us.
We realized we lived it every day and our audience saw this. So we thought that if we doubled down on this, that it actually made a bigger statement.
Daniels goes by Ray and joined us recently to talk about these composers and how he hopes their work opens the classical world to more people like him.
I'm from a small town in Eufaula, Alabama, red dirt roads, and my parents were farmers. And, you know, that's probably not the place where you would think a classical conductor or composer would come from. And, you know, I never really saw a lot of people that looked like me on the stage or doing the things that I was interested in doing. And as I've done research and collaborated creating this series, I've learned that there are so many more people that are like me doing this work. And to share this with my audience has been, you know, so refreshing. It's almost like, hey, I'm not the only one, and everyone should know about this. Why don't we know about this?
You sent us pieces from 5 composers that you featured this year, featuring this year. Any of those particularly meaningful to you?
They all represent some just great corners and perspectives from their era and time that they composed. But I really think I identify with Tom Wiggins, also known as Blind Tom. Tom Wiggins was born 1849, you know, just at the end of slavery. And he actually was born in Columbus, Georgia, which is really about an hour away from where I was born in Eufaula, Alabama. And he was blind. His parents were sold to a rich lawyer in Columbus. The lawyer's name was James Bethune. He had a five-year-old daughter who was taking piano lessons. And Tom Wiggins listened to her play the piano and learned all of her songs and started to compose music. And the slave owner noticed that he was a real genius, and he totally was a genius. He was hired out to another Southerner who was also a concert promoter, Perry Oliver. And they toured him around the United States for the next 30 years, even after slavery. There was a big battle for custody. And he basically became their cash cow. He was the highest earning pianist in the 19th century. I mean, this is a big deal. He earned them about $100,000 a year, and in this day, that would be about $1.5 million. His parents didn't receive any of that money. He didn't receive any of that money, and he was just a magnificent composer and artist, and he was actually promoted as like this gorilla baboon sight freak, but he was really just an amazing genius. And when I think of this series and I think of someone that I just admire and to see his work and know that he was, you know, he grew up so close to where I grew up, it's a big impact for me.
It was actually my favorite too, Ray, of the pieces that you sent. Let's listen to a little bit of it. This is from Water in the Moonlight, and it's performed by Erilyn Mitchell on harp. Juxtaposition of that beauty with the story you just told is remarkable. Is that often the case with the composers that you've chosen to feature?
Every single one of them, they all have these just amazing stories, and the artistry is so just unbelievably exuberant, talent, highest level. I have been just blown away, absolutely.
Let's listen to another one. Producer Paris Alston and I were also both struck by La Bella Cubana by Jose White. Let me play a little bit of that for you. Tell us about this piece and this composer.
His mother was Afro-Cuban, and he was raised in Cuba. When he was 18, he actually were playing some Rossini compositions, and he attended the Paris Conservatory, believe it or not, and he won the top prize, the Grand Prix there, and he became really well-known. He was, again, a prodigy. Not only did he win this at a very early age, but he also taught at the Paris Conservatory. Again, touring in Boston, New York, Philadelphia. He was just an amazing violinist, and he taught at the conservatory in Rio de Janeiro as well. Again, playing and writing music of his homeland, you can hear that kind of Cuban sound in his compositions. And this time, you know, I think he's born in 1836, died in 1918. To have this type of status as an artist of color was amazing.
What have listeners lost by not knowing of these composers and their work. And if we had, especially in the last, let's say, 100, 150 years, if they had been better known, how would our definition of classical music be different now?
There's a lot in that question. One of the things that I think we have lost is the contribution. You know, these composers have contributed great works of art to this particular medium, and it's not recognized. Not only that, we don't even today recognize current composers of African descent that are right now creating fantastic works of art. It's almost unheard of, but it's actually quite common. We don't reap the benefits of feeling that music and enjoying that music and experiencing that music. There's a whole plethora of undiscovered wonderfulness that we are not even enjoying. So I think that we're in store for a new horizon of music and culture to discover. And I'm extremely excited about that.
You're a conductor. Has conducting these composers stretched you in your skill set in some new way or helped you fall in love with or discover something different?
I wouldn't say necessarily stretched me in some new way, but definitely made me fall in love with it a little deeper. Again, being a person of color doing this type of work, for a long time for me, I felt alone. I felt kind of isolated. You know, I didn't have a lot of people around me doing this type of work that looked like me. And to know that there are so many others who are contributing to this, that has been, for me as a conductor, something very special. And it makes me want to share that. We did William Grant Steele's first symphony, his African-American symphony. And sharing that with the audience was just so exhilarating. And watching the audience react to it, you know, it features a banjo, you know, which is an instrument that was invented by African-Americans. In a symphony, that's almost unheard of. Just to hear those warm blue notes and southern sounds, it made me actually fall in love with the music more and made me feel as though I'm not an anomaly, that I belong here.
I want to play songs from one more composer. The composer is William Grant Still. And the song, which is performed by the Fall River Symphony Orchestra Principal String Quartet, is the sentimental one. Let's listen to a little bit of that. So I understand that William Grant Still accomplished a number of firsts, conducted first African-American to conduct a major symphony orchestra in the U.S., a major symphony orchestra in the Deep South, a major American network radio orchestra. Tell us about him and his pioneering role in America in classical music.
William Grant Still, he was in some ways so prolific. He got his training really with the W.C. Handy Band back in 1916. And he really learned how to orchestrate and to write for this fantastic band. But even before then, he went to school in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he learned the violin at the age of 15. He also taught himself clarinet and saxophone, oboe and bass and cello and viola, so many different things. And he actually went to school to be a doctor, to study medicine. But I believe he quit school and went to Oberlin. And throughout his career, he met lots of composers. He met female composer Margaret Bonds. They both knew another female composer, great Florence Price, and they collaborated with Langston Hughes. So I think some of the things that William Grant Still did, especially as a member of the Harlem Renaissance pioneers, explored lots of different areas of music from artists of color and deep roots in the South and the experience that was happening in Jim Crow. So I think That was his root. That was his beginning. His works were performed in Europe, in Berlin, London, Tokyo, and he was the first American, not just African-American, first American to have an opera premiered at the New York City Opera in 1939. He did lots of wonderful things, conducted film scores and wrote film music. As I said, he was prolific.
You've talked about his performances, where he broke through. You also talked about feeling very alone in this classical music world as a person of color as you were coming up. And it has historically been an elite world, an exclusive one, at least here in the United States. We have known it as a white Western European world. Are you hoping that sharing these composers, sharing this music, invites young aspiring composers of color and musicians of color to find their place and own their place and feel like they belong in this world of classical music?
Absolutely. And I'm not alone in that. Actually, on this Sunday, Chichi Nwanoku, she is the founder and artistic director of the Chineke Orchestra. And this is the first professional orchestra that's made up of majority Black, Asians, and ethnically diverse musicians in Europe. She was actually kind of inspired by the Sphinx organization, Aaron Dworkin, who started that here in Michigan. In Boston, we have Project Step. So there are lots of classical musicians of color who are out there who I think probably to some degree have a very similar experience as I did. And I think doing this type of work, talking about these composers, it gives us a more of a stage on the stage, if that makes sense. Gives us more of a stake in what is actually happening. I think because the lack of diversity, we haven't necessarily been invited to the table. And so I think what I would love to do is to say, excuse me, but I need a seat. Please move over and let me have a seat at this table. And that is exactly my intention. And also to let others, especially young musicians of color and composers and performers, to say, you know, this is for you. This is yours as well. So come to the table.
That's Douglas McRae Daniels, director of the Fall River Symphony Orchestra. Ray, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going out on Henry by Afro-British musician and virtuoso violinist George Bridgetower, performed by mezzo Ariella Rogers and pianist Judy Conrad. The Fall River Symphony will be performing composers of African descent, the contemporary voice, as part of their spring presentation this Sunday, May 16th. You can find more information at our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.